Good morning. This is Friday, August 10th, 2012, the second lecture at Freiburg New Church Assembly. My name is Lee Wolfenden, and my topic this morning is on exploding books. And as I was heading into the lecture hall, Tom asked me whether we should wear protective gear for this lecture. And I said, I don't think there are going to be any. I was thinking that if I had done it the way Susanna did her lecture and I was doing it with a live presentation, then it might actually be a dangerous lecture, but I figured it would probably be better not to do that in this particular instance. So if we have any explosions, I think they're going to be rhetorical explosions, and they'll probably take place mostly during the Q&A afterwards. Because I'm aware that I'm talking about things we've been discussing and debating in our Q&A and in our discussion groups all week, and I'm also aware that no matter what I say here, there's going to be somebody who will have a cavil or something to say that's not so. And that's what the Q&A is for. So I'm just going to lay it out there, and then we can talk about how I'm all wrong. The memorable relation I'm going to talk about today is all about the nature of truth. 2,000 years ago, Pontius Pilate asked a Jewish rabbi a question, and that question was, what is truth? If the rabbi answered that question, his answer unfortunately did not make it into print. That was the end of the conversation. It ended with a question, what is truth? And perhaps the question is unanswerable in the abstract. Truth is so fundamental to the universe that other things are defined in reference to it. It is like an axiom that is the starting point of a syllogism. We can draw conclusions once we've accepted the axiom, but the axiom itself stands on its own as a given. What is truth? Truth just is, and then from there we can perhaps draw some conclusions. Manuel Swedenborg did offer some general definitions of truth along the lines of truth is the form of good, if that's helpful to you at all. And in some of our previous Q&A sessions this week, I've offered the slightly less abstract definition, truth is the way things really are. However, I suspect that practically speaking, the question, what is truth, can be answered for us only in the course of our own life experience. It can be only answered in the course of our daily lives as we struggle to understand the world around us, the world within us. If truth is anything at all, it must be something that we can experience for ourselves, and this is where we answer for ourselves the question, what is truth? When we look at Swedenborg's writings, the memorable relations are where we especially find the practical experience that might give us some secondhand experience that will help us perhaps to identify what is truth in our own experience. For all the abstract parts of his writings, it's in the stories where we find the concrete imagery that may help our earthbound minds and our image-centered minds to actually grasp what in the world is this thing that we call truth. For this hour, we'll look at how one of the memorable relations addresses that question fairly directly, and that memorable relation is found in Revelation Unveiled, or traditionally Apocalypse Revealed, section 566. The same memorable occurrence, by the way, is repeated with slight variations in True Christianity number 162. This memorable relation is in the common format, common to Swedenborg, that is, of a debate. Some spirits are debating, quote, whether we can see any theological truth in the Bible without the Lord's help. This question is batted around in various forms with the general conclusion that we do need the Lord's help to see any truth in the Bible. After this conclusion, things start to get less abstract and more colorful. In a reference to imagery found in Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 to 11, some spirits that from a distance look like locusts come up from another region identified as the abyss. Obviously, these are bad guys. Swedenborg identifies them as people who in the world had prayed to the Father and had convinced themselves of justification by faith alone. These spirits, and we don't need to dig into all, if you want the full version, read Apocalypse Revealed 566 and you'll get it, because there's more commentary on the specific beliefs that they have. But basically, for our purposes, these spirits believe that they can clearly see truth in the Bible and that it is supportive of their particular doctrinal position, which is one of Swedenborg's favorite whipping boys, and that is the position that faith alone saves. And they're convinced that they can see this clearly in the Bible. At this point, word comes down from heaven that these people do not even know one theological truth from the Bible. In the ensuing rather rancorous debate, they are further told that their light is deceptive light, such that they see darkness as light and light as darkness. And this is demonstrated to them by their looking up and seeing that the sky looked dark, but when they look down into their abyss, things look light, which is essentially into hell, things look light. And at this point in the story, we get a very compact presentation. Who says Swedenborg can't be short and sweet? We get a very compact two-sentence presentation of the classic argument about absolute truth versus relative truth, which is one of the things we've been discussing and debating in our Q&As and in our discussions all week. It says that these spirits from the abyss represented this presentation that they saw light as darkness and darkness as light. In other words, they resented the fact that when they looked up, it looked dark, and down, it looked light. They said that this meant, if this is true, that it means that light and darkness are nothing but states of the eye. They were then told, though, that no, light is light, and darkness is darkness. If we use Swedenborg's common identification of light as truth and darkness as falsity, we can read these sentences in this way. The spirits from the abyss tried to claim that the other side's position meant that truth is in the eye of the beholder. In other words, truth is whatever we ourselves see as truth, which will be different for every person. But they were told in response, no, there really are such things as truth and falsity objectively out there. There is light and there is darkness. The issue is whether we see the truth accurately or inaccurately. For those engaged in false thinking, what is really true looks false, and what is really false looks true. In other words, light looks like darkness, darkness looks like light. Of course, this raises the huge question of whether any of us can see truth accurately, something we've been talking about also, whether any of us can know that what we see accurately represents reality, or whether for all practical purposes, truth might as well be relative, because we can't know whether what we see is really true or false. And the skepticism inherent in the second position that tends to lead us right back to the idea that light and darkness are nothing but states of the eye. In other words, maybe there is truth and falsity objectively out there, but if we can't see it or know that we're seeing light that's actually light and darkness that's actually darkness, we might as well just say truth is relative because none of us can know what the truth is. Now, I recognize that there are all kinds of philosophical arguments that make it difficult for thinking people to accept that there is truth and that truth is knowable. I find these arguments interesting, and I've read quite a few of them, and there's a lot of them in other memorable relations. There's one classic memorable relation where these people are able to prove anything they want, and they're asked to prove that a crow is white, which they then proceed to do quite skillfully. They also prove that a black rock is white, and they are asked whether they can prove that they themselves are insane. And they said, we can, but we don't want to. So after a while of reading these arguments, I just have to go back to practical experience. We see with our own eyes that there is such a thing as light and darkness. When the sun is out, it's light out. When the sun is behind the earth, it's dark, except for where we make artificial light. It seems when we get into practical experience, it's pretty obvious for all our philosophical arguments that light is light, and darkness is darkness. And that's what these angels, who are really the ones who are speaking and saying, no, there is light and there's darkness, that's what they're saying. Or correspondentially, there actually is a truth, and we can see that truth. How well we see that truth is another question, but we are capable of seeing something that's true and of, I believe, of knowing that it's true. So why, given these practical experiences of being able to see that there is light out there, even a blind person who can't see the light will acknowledge that the light is there. I may not be able to see it, but I know that my friend sees it, and my friend can describe to me what he or she is seeing in the light. So if we have this practical experience of seeing light and darkness and knowing pretty clearly that there is a difference, that there's an objective out there difference between light and darkness, why do we have such a hard time accepting that there really is such a thing as objective truth and falsity out there? I believe the reason that is our mind is that our minds are not driven by light, but by heat. We are not driven by our thinking mind. We are driven by our loves, by our heart, by our motives. We have desires that push us forward, and those desires mold our mind to their bidding. If there's something we want and we believe we should have, our mind will find a way to justify saying that it's right that I should have that thing, even if it's not right that I should have that thing. It's our desires and our drive, Swedenborg says, that really, and I think our experience bears this out, that in the end are going to form what we think. And if it's our desires and motives that are going to form what we think, our perception of reality is going to, in the end, be dependent upon our heart, on our feelings, on our drives, on our motives, on our goals. That's going to color what we see. And that is precisely where this memorable relation goes next. It maintains the general trend of moving from the abstract to the concrete. Eventually, it does get to the exploding books. The abyssal spirits are not happy to be told that they can see no truth in the Bible, and they set about to prove that they can too see truth in the Bible. And here's where we might expect the classic story that they're going to start spouting all these things that they say are true when, in fact, we know they're false. And what I find most fascinating about this memorable relation is that's not what happens at all. As a matter of fact, these spirits from the abyss who believe in faith alone quote a whole bunch of things from, they don't actually quote the Bible, but they make a whole bunch of statements from the Bible that we Swedenborgians actually agree with. You can read the list for yourself if you like, but there's no problem with any of the statements that they make. They're all actually true in themselves. They're not false. And so these spirits do this tour de force listing of all these things that they're pretty sure that their listeners are going to agree with, and that in fact their listeners do agree with. And they say, can any of you deny any of these truths? Yet you say that we in our schools have no truth, not even one. Haven't you made these accusations against us out of spite? And at this point, things get even more interesting, and we're given some vivid visual imagery to illustrate, to illustrate the answer. And now I'm going to read a fairly long section from the memorable relation. Then, though, the following was given in reply. All these beliefs you have cited are true in and of themselves, but you have falsified them by using them to support a false premise. This means that for you and your colleagues, they are falsified truths that derive their falsity from a false premise. We will even give you a visual demonstration of this. There is a place nearby where light from heaven flows in directly. There is a table in the middle of this place, and when someone places on it a sheet of paper with truths from the Bible written on it, that sheet shines like a star because of the truth written on it. So write your truths on a sheet of paper and put it on the table, and we'll see. They did so and gave the sheet to the caretaker who put it on the table. He told them, "Stand back and look at the table." So they stood back and looked, and suddenly the sheet shone like a star. Then the caretaker said to them, "You see that what you wrote on the sheet is true, but move closer and look intently at the sheet." They did this, and immediately the light disappeared and the sheet turned as black as soot from a furnace. The caretaker went on to say, "Touch the sheet with your hands." I think he had a little bit of a devil in him, that caretaker. "Touch the sheet with your hands, but be careful not to touch the writing." A little bit of devil. And when they did, the sheet burst into flames and burned up. When they saw this, they ran away, and they were told, and I suspect that meant they sort of backed off from it, you know, boom, if something burst into flame in your fingers, what's your reaction? You jump away from there. They saw this and ran away, and they were told, if you had touched the writings, you would have heard a thunderclap, and your fingers would have gotten burnt. In one translation, it says your fingers would have caught fire. Now, here is a fascinating statement and visual imagery to back it up. In a nutshell, if we're operating from false premises, even statements that in themselves are true become false for us because we distort them. And I find this just fascinating. People can say something that in itself is true, and yet for them it functions as falsity. And here's a simple example. Consider the statement, "She is rich." Now, if the woman in question has a lot of money, that statement is true, at least on a material level. Now consider that certain people who interpret quite literally some of Jesus' statements about the rich and the poor have come to the conclusion that being rich is evil in and of itself, and that being poor is a virtue in and of itself. Someone with this view of wealth and poverty would hear the statement, "She is rich," very differently from the average person who thinks that wealth is good, especially if I have it. In fact, someone who views wealth as intrinsically evil is very likely to think, when hearing the statement, "She is rich," that this is the same thing as saying, "She is evil." This, from a Swedenborgian perspective at least, is an example of a statement that in itself is true, becoming falsified due to a person distorting it based on a false premise. We see this fact that she is rich, and yet these people interpret that as this person is evil, and that statement, "She is rich," becomes false for them because it's distorted from its real meaning. What this means for us is that seeing the truth is not enough. We can spot all kinds of things that in themselves are true without seeing a single genuine truth ourselves. Others may see the truth in what we're saying, and yet for us, those things are false. In general, if our use of the truth is to condemn others and to exalt ourselves, all the quote-unquote truth that we possess functions as falsity for us because we have distorted it based on our own false beliefs and also, in the end, based on our self-centered and greedy desires for power, for pleasure, for ourselves at the expense of others. According to Swedenborg, this is actually the source of all falsity. Falsity is simply distorted truth. It really doesn't have a life of its own. It derives from truth, but that truth gets distorted into something that is deceptive and misleading. And the appeal of the common false ideas in the world around us is that all of them do have a grain of truth within them. There is a grain of truth in every false idea. Otherwise, it couldn't have any existence at all. And we humans thirst for that grain of truth, and yet in the end we often end up swallowing a whole bucket full of deception when we're really trying to sift out that grain of truth and find that. Unfortunately, as the story continues, we see illustrated the common experience that people who are misusing that grain of truth for their own faulty motives can be quite convinced that they have their hands on God's own truth. They see the truth as it objectively is. They see the light, and they're going to tell us what it is. Usually the faulty motives are some form of desire for personal power, for possessions, for pleasure. And here's where the exploding books come in. After the above events, the assembled group is told that if they think this place is cool, they should see the place down the road where there's a table on which is a copy of the Bible that gives visual and other feedback on whether a person approaching it is engaged in genuine truth or enmeshed in falsified thinking. To make a long story a bit shorter, once the group has repaired to this amazing place, there appears on the scene an eminent faith-alone theologian who had talked a lot about goodwill, charity, good actions, but did not in fact believe that the way we live has anything to do with our salvation. Even though he talked a lot about doing good for others, he thought that was basically for show and that the real thing we need to do to save is to believe in Jesus, obviously, that it's our faith, it's our belief that saves us, not the way we live. This man was so confident that he had not falsified the Bible that despite a warning from the angel caretaker, he strode up to the table and touched the Bible. And here's the result. Flame and smoke suddenly shot out of the Bible, and there was an explosion with a loud bang that threw him into the corner of the room. For quite a few minutes, he lay there as if he were dead. Unfortunately, here on earth, we do not usually get this kind of obvious visual feedback on whether whether our minds and our lives are engaged in genuine truth or distortion of the truth. But I believe that if we are paying attention, we can over time receive the feedback we need as to whether or not we're on the right track. And I believe that often that feedback comes in the form of our relationships with others. One of the ways to receive this feedback is to notice whether our attitude and actions make our relationships with others better or worse. If we find ourselves having persistent problems getting along with the people around us, it is, of course, possible that everyone around us has serious problems. And that's what we would tend to like to think. But in the more likely explanation is that we ourselves have some work to do in straightening out our own head and heart. So we do get the feedback we need, but fortunately for us, we don't need protective gear most of the time in order to receive that. Some of the time we actually do, but most of the time people don't come to fisticuffs in our experience, and we're able to perceive the feedback on whether our attitudes and our beliefs are helpful and right, whether we're seeing light as light, or whether we're dealing with false views and faulty motives that are causing us to continually get into conflict based on our own wrong thoughts and feelings. So once we get this feedback, then of course our job is to work on ourselves, to work on straightening out our attitudes, which in the end involves straightening out our heart. What are our goals? What are our motives? What is driving us? And if what's driving us is primarily our own pleasure, our own power, our own self, if we're pretty primarily wrapped up in ourselves, we're going to be adopting faulty attitudes based on that, and we're going to get into conflicts with others, and we're going to end out having struggles and troubles within ourselves and in our own lives. And all of us do, because all of us have some faulty motives, all of us have some faulty attitudes, and all of us have things to work on within ourselves. And that, of course, is the work of regeneration or spiritual truth that is the whole point of our life here on earth. The floor is yours.
George Stoll, a couple of thoughts. I find a very direct connection between this business of truth and how I get along with people in simply, do I see you in the light of my faith? Mm-hmm. Can I see you in the Lord's light? Or do I see you as someone I need to criticize, someone I need to outwit, someone I need to contradict? It makes a huge difference. But I got distracted, I must confess, at one point. It kept happening about this business of seeing the light. So I performed an experiment. I held my hand over the nice white chair here, and my arm, I can see a shadow on the thing. If I look between my arm and the shadow, I don't see any shade. I don't see any difference. Do I see the light, or do I see nothing but what the light falls on? I think there is some sense in which we see light, but I'm bewildered as to what sense that is. It should look darker, shouldn't it, between here and there? Mm-hmm. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. I don't see any shade, any shading of the light between my arm. I fully see the shadow.
I'm not going to touch the second one with a 10-foot pole, but the first, I love where Swedenborg talks about approaching things from the positive principle versus approaching it from the negative principle. And also, he talks in a similar vein about how angels approach people and how devils approach people, devils and evil spirits approach people. And he says, taking the worst first, when an evil spirit approaches us, what that evil spirit does is look for all the things that are wrong in us and emphasize those and bring those out and then condemn us because of them. And if that evil spirit finds anything good in us, that evil spirit is going to find some negative interpretation for that and still accuse us and drag us down in that way. Whereas when an angel or a good spirit approaches us, that angel or good spirit looks for everything good in us and draws that out and focuses on that. And anything evil in us, anything evil and false in us, minimizes that. And that I've taken as instruction for how to interact well with other people. If we are looking for what's wrong with them, and we're looking for what to criticize them for, we're going to find it. because none of us is perfect. We're going to find it, and there are things wrong with every one of us. It's quite easy to identify it in other people. It's not so easy to identify it ourselves. There's a great little bit from Swedenborg where he says that criticizing others and seeing their faults is very easy because it just requires an intellectual, a fairly surface-level intellectual effort. We've learned what's right and wrong. We look at them, we see what's wrong, and we identify it, and we accuse them and say, you shouldn't do that, it's wrong. But when we're looking at ourselves, it's much more difficult because criticizing ourselves and seeing what's wrong in ourselves requires a change of will. Because when we identify something in ourselves that's wrong, if we're going to stick with that, we actually have to change ourselves. And that means changing our heart underneath it all. So it's very difficult to see it in ourselves. And if we're unwilling to make that change, in general, we're unwilling to see it. We just will not see that thing about ourselves. Others see it clear as day. We don't see it. So if we're approaching others to see the evil in them, we're going to find it, and we're going to be able to criticize them, and we're going to be able to tear them down, and it's not going to do any good at all. But if we approach that person and we say, no matter how bad this looks, there's something good in there, and I'm going to look for that and try to find that and try to draw that out, then it's not that we're ignoring the evil, it's that we're not condemning people for the evil. It's not that we're putting blinders on and saying everything's fine with that person, because they may be acting out pretty badly. But what we're looking for is, what's the good? What is this person searching for and not finding? Where can I find the good in this person and bring that out and make things better? Other thoughts, reactions, questions? Yes, Jane.
This question about, you know, how we perceive ourselves and how we perceive other people, I think, you know, the two are definitely very intimately connected, and that all of it really starts with me and how I perceive myself, how I perceive you, how I perceive the world mm-hmm. in general, all of that. And so that this... We start out by believing it's all out there. Mm-hmm. It really is there. You really are a lousy speaker. You really are, you know.
I resemble that remark.
Right, right. Yeah, and I honestly don't think that. But I think the contrary. And but that it's coming. It is the way. It's the glasses I'm wearing through which it's the filter through mm-hmm. which I perceive you. That colors it that way. And so therefore becoming aware of the fact which glasses I'm wearing and recognizing that they are glasses, therefore they're not me. I can mm-hmm. take them off. Mm-hmm. And that's not who I am. But also having to recognize, and this of course is where the real magic is that I'm not that way either. I'm not a lousy speaker or unintelligent or blah blah blah, whatever it is, you know, that this is my, I've been conditioned somehow somewhere along the way by a whole variety of different things. You can't really put your finger on directly on much of that, where it came from, but if I get a handle on it, then for myself, and I start getting my glasses off through which I perceive myself, I look at you completely differently. You know, it's just because I'm feeling really good here, mm-hmm. and I just look for the best and in you. And yes, there may be some faults, but I also recognize so-called faults, let's put it that way, that you're conditioned too, you know, as is everyone. And so it's not innately who you are, it's some the glasses you're wearing, mm-hmm. you know, that causes you to be that way. So
just a related thing that was brought up by it's not innately who you are. Swedenborg tells us that even the worst devil in hell has a level above which he or she is an angel of heaven. It's just that that person isn't accessing that part of themselves. There's a barrier beyond which we're not allowed to destroy ourselves, and it sometimes is higher and sometimes is lower. That person is acting out of a lower part of himself or herself and has destroyed a lot of that part of the character. But no matter who you're talking with, there, if you can get to it, there's a place where that person is good.
That's it, yeah. That's
and that applies great. To ourselves as well. A guard had his hand up next.
Hello, Guard Perry. Thank you, Lee. So on this question of truth, with what Jane just said, I recall looking up the word being. Actually, it was a note in the New Century edition, and one of the notes is that being can mean, and in this case means isness. It is. Mm-hmm. And I heard that is a way to answer the question, what is truth? Well, it is what is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that does lead to the outside view, meaning it is out there. Well, if it helps to realize there are actually three ways to conjugate, I think is the right word, the verb to be. Only one of which is it is.
Mm-hmm.
Second one is you are. And the third one, actually I'm going in reverse order, is I am. And I'm finding it helpful to say I can ask all three questions. Not all at once, but one at a time. Okay, it is. Lee said this. I heard him say it. It is what he said. Or it's not. Okay, and I'm not sure. Now I don't know where to go with that, but that would be one.
I don't either. So we're in the same boat.
I want to say something that's clear. I don't want to say something that's more confusing. So that I'm saying that's only one dimension of what's significant in what he said, but it is significant. Maybe the next one to go to is I am. I am hearing that he said this. Now that's going to be different than what he said because it's going to be my interpretation of it. So I would responsibly say, by the way, Lee, I heard you say this. That's a very valid thing, and Lee would be interested in that. Is that what you heard? Wow, that's neat. I'm glad you said that, which then does lead to the third dimension, you are, which allows Lee to say, you are interpreting that in a very interesting way. So I've just gone through all three dimensions of the verb to be around the issue of truth, and I find that helpful to get out of the isness question because it takes responsibility to say, I heard you. I think that's what Jane just said, the I dimension, which leads to the appreciation of who you are. Okay, that's enough. I hope that was enough.
Thank you. We've got
Pat Perry. I think that we can learn about ourselves when we criticize others. We're projecting our own weaknesses onto others. We don't criticize other people for things that we ourselves, I think, are free from. So it's a projection process. We're not seeing the other person clearly. We see our own faults, I think, in others. And then if we could, maybe we don't take that back to ourselves. It's easier to see someone else, reversing it. It's easier to see someone else who's criticizing and to see that that's where that's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It's their problem that they're seeing in others. It's easier to see it that way. But
when you're doing the projecting, it's a lot harder to see.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can see it coming from the other way.
One of my teachers once told about an exercise that one of his teachers had the students do, and that was to think about the most annoying person, the person that just really bugs you, and just write down a brief list of all the things about that person that bugs you, but leave a little bit of space to the right of it because you're going to need to write something there. So after the students had gotten the list all compiled, he had them all write the words before it, I am. And then read the list. And the teacher who was telling this to me said that he had done this about a certain person that he had just found extremely annoying. But once he was done that exercise, he became really good friends with the kid. He was a teenager at the time. I think it's quite true. I also think that The spiritual world, a lot of the mechanics of the spiritual world do work for us psychologically here on Earth. In the spiritual world, we see around us the things that reflect our inner being and also the inner being of the group that we're with. The scenery actually changes according to who we are inwardly, and we see it outwardly. I think the same thing happens for us psychologically. We're inhabiting a particular world in our head, and we're at some level aware of our problems. We may not want to admit them, but we're aware of them, and they are present in our thinking, and they color our thinking. But if we're in the active process of not wanting to admit that we have this issue or this problem, we're still going to see it. It's just we can't, because that's where our head is. It's just that we can't see it on our side ourselves, so we see it out there. What is going on in our own head is being projected into the world around us, and when we're talking psychologically, that's not the physical world, although that can sometimes happen. It's the relational world in which we live. Our inner state is projected out into the relationships that we have with others. And as you say, we can see that so clearly when other people are doing it, it's so hard to see it when we ourselves are doing it. But that exercise of when we're criticizing somebody, put the I am in front of it, it can be very instructive at times. Yes.
Jane Fullerton, I don't know why I was thinking about this, but I would thank you, Guard, for that three, I am, you are, what was the third one? It is. And I was thinking of Exodus. I teach a class, and I was thinking of the class that I teach, and there are, like, this is a different translation in the Bible that I use in the classroom that I teach, and I teach a class on visions of the underworld, so we talk all about the hells, whatever culture we talk about, but, it was like, what is his name? What is God's name? And in one of the translations, I am that I am.
Yep.
And then in this one, it's I shall prove to be what I shall prove to be. And I find that interesting when I'm thinking about the truth, and the truth just is.
Yeah.
And sometimes I can't even wrap my brain about that around that. And I just wanted to say that when you were talking about getting through those, what are my motivations? What am I motivated by? Am I motivated by fear? And if I'm motivated by fear, where am I going with that? You know, what are my actions going to be? And I was thinking directly of an experience when you were sharing just now of how questioning myself, how do I relate to this other person? And I, what you just said just completely resonated. I have to look in the mirror when if I'm pointing the finger, this, that, and the other thing, then I need to step back and say, well, what part of me am I looking at if I'm projecting onto the other person these, I don't even like to say negative, but negative things. So I know that was kind of a whirlwind, but I am that I am. It is what it is. So I don't know, and I really liked your lecture. So
thank you.
A lot for me to think about today.
Thank you. It strikes me that hypocrisy is a term that we cast about and mostly apply to other people, and yet there are spiritual and psychological dynamics behind it. There's a reason why the pot calls the kettle black, and it has to do with where we are in our regeneration process and whether we are doing our inner work or not. And if we're not doing our inner work, it's likely that we're going to be accusing others of the same things we're doing ourselves, hence the whole dynamic of hypocrisy, which is a major part of our human experience here on Earth. Yes.
Yes, Martha Richardson, and thank you, Lee. I'd like to say we don't recognize a problem. We don't recognize love. We don't recognize faults unless we know them. And that's how we deal with other people.
What do you mean by know them?
Unless they're ourselves. Unless if we love something, then we recognize that love in someone else. If we have a problem, then we recognize that problem in someone else. If we have faults, that's the faults we see in other people. We don't know anything that we haven't experienced.
There's so much folk wisdom contained in our common sayings, and one of them is, it takes one to know one. If we don't have it in ourselves, we simply can't see it elsewhere. A Other thoughts, questions, reactions? Yes. Let's get the mic over there.
Quick comment that typically we use that it takes one to know one as sort of a blaming statement, but it mm-hmm. also can be a self-realization statement. Hey, mm-hmm. oh, I see that because it is in me. I have that same problem.
Yeah. I think this whole social world in which we humans are social animals, this whole social world that we live in is sort of a reflection machine where we can see our own inner thoughts reflected outside, and it becomes visual. Swedenborg, in the spiritual world, Swedenborg witnessed many things where it became objectively, physically, well, you know, as much as it is physical there, but objectively, outwardly real, so you could see it visually, visually presented to you. I think that dreams, in our last lecture, we talked about dreams, and dreams are often a way that the mechanics and feelings and goings on in our mind are presented to us in visual fashion so that we can see them projected out there. We have the same experience in our interactions with others where it's a whole laboratory to tell us about ourselves. And if we can be paying attention more to what message am I getting that can help me to see myself more clearly and accurately and to take the steps I need to make in my life, this whole world out here becomes a lot more useful than if we're primarily using it as a way to see what's wrong with everybody else and correct their wrongs. So I think that God has marvelously designed this social world for us in order to give us the feedback we need if we're willing to pay attention to it and keep on giving it to us even when we're not willing to pay attention to it until we do pay attention to it.
Thanks, Lee. I didn't get to hear your lecture. I want a summary in the discussion. But what just came up for me is some relationship writer I read said that perhaps the most damaging strategy we grab onto is defensiveness, mm-hmm. which keeps us from seeing the lesson that's in front of us.
Mm-hmm. I recall very vividly an experience I had when I was young and even more foolish than I am today, and I was making my living, younger, I should say, and I was making my living doing odd jobs, mowing people's lawns, trimming their hedges and stuff like this. And I was, I was young and unconnected and didn't have any particular need to be there, but, you know, I usually showed up. And sometimes I showed up late, and people didn't like that. And so I showed up one time, and it was one too many times that I was late for this particular fellow, and he started chewing me out. And, of course, my first reaction was, what are you yelling at me for? You know, and I didn't say anything, fortunately, but I was going to defend myself and say, well, I was busy and I had to do something before I came here and all this sort of stuff. And then I was thinking, you know, he actually has a reason to be upset with me. I mean, I told him I was going to be here at 10 o'clock and here it is 10:30 and I'm showing up and he's been sitting here waiting for me for half an hour. And I happen to know that this guy who is partially disabled is kind of a lonely old fellow. And, you know, he probably didn't enjoy sitting there waiting for half an hour while I decide to show up. I said, I guess he has the right to yell at me. So he yelled at me and told me what a piece of trash I was for about 20 minutes, I think, or at least that's how it felt. And I figured, okay, you know, I just have to listen to this because, I just have to. So he got all of that out of his system. And once he had properly chewed me out, he started saying, well, you know, you do fairly good work. And you know, I kind of still, because at first it was like I was finished. I was done with this guy. And he said, you do pretty good work. And he started saying some nice things about me. And he said, but you got to show up on time. So I said, okay. And I was able to continue in relationship with this person because unlike what I would tend to do, I actually managed to stop myself before I got defensive and just listen to what he was saying to me. And take that in and recognize that I did have to change the way that I was being toward him and toward others. And being able to be non-defensive at that point allowed me to continue in a relationship that otherwise would have been broken and would have ended.
I want to back up that with a similar experience that just happened within the last month, and it's a little different. But I was needing my car worked on, and a mechanic was there, and it was a simple job, and he was talking to me while he was replacing the battery and checking the alternator. And it happened to be that he was representing what I would think of as the right wing of the Republican Party and why that was needed in our country today. And I normally don't like to listen to that, but this guy was working on my car. And I did not want to interfere with that. He was going about half speed, but he was getting the work done. I was watching his hands. But he really was saying some things I totally disagreed with and mostly would have blocked out. But I happened to be able to stand there and, well, I said, just like Lee, I said, I have to listen to this. Because I didn't want to get into an argument with him while he was working on my car. And lo and behold, I found it interesting to listen. It didn't bother me as much to be that open in sort of this odd, objective way. And not only that, when he both finished the job okay, and when he was done, he looked at me in such a way, or he acknowledged, he said, "Wow, that was fun." He said, "I love talking to people about this." And it wasn't just that he was expressing his own views. It was that it was as if he said, "We just had a great conversation." And what I took from that is that he's in a position where he will have a lot of conversations where people aren't listening. For one of two reasons. One is that they disagree, or the other is that they agree so much, you know, they're just talking to themselves. Mm-hmm. And this was an experience where someone listened to him, and it changed the dynamic of the conversation and mm-hmm. the reaction, the reality. Mm-hmm. I couldn't resist saying that something similar has just happened to me.
Thank you.
Okay, we still have time.
What you're saying is when you listen to someone, you're saying, You're important. I'll listen to what you have to say.
Yes, and it and two people change. One is the listener, because to me it was a fab. I didn't think I could listen to that, but I did. You know, in this case, it was because I didn't want to interfere with his working on the car. But once I got there, it was fabulous, and he changed a little bit. I think we're not going to be best buddies.
One of the things that helps me now that I'm older and a little bit less foolish than I used to be is to realize that deciding what is the truth and decreeing what is the truth is really not my job. It's God's job, and I have to try to figure out what I think is the truth and try to see it more and more clearly, but it's really not my job to decide what's true in an ultimate sense. It's not my job to hold down that position in the world where I'm the guy that has to let everybody know what's really true. That's God's job. And there's a great section in Divine Providence where Swedenborg talks about how all of the instruction we receive is actually from God. Even if we're hearing it from ministers and teachers, what's happening there is that we're hearing these words that are coming from the ministers or teachers. They're coming in, and God is working and putting meaning on them based on our experience and what we are able to perceive. So as a matter of fact, I have taught you nothing today, and neither has Sage, and neither has anybody that you've ever listened to. It doesn't make sense, and Swedenborg kind of acknowledges that, but basically the only person who has ever taught you anything is God, and all we've done is for each other is provide some raw material that God can pull together and put into a form that makes some sense to us. And it's parallel to what actually happens when we see things. We think that, you know, our eyes sort of that the light kind of flows in and it makes images in the brain. That's not what's happening at all. What's happening is even from the point that the light hits the rods and cones, there's all kinds of interpretation taking place. It's being processed, and the farther it goes into the brain, it's more and more processed. The brain is actually reaching out, grabbing those impulses and putting it together into an image that we can see. So we're actually forming that visual image from within. It's not just coming in and hitting us. So if I'm speaking words to you and you're gaining understanding, really that understanding is coming from God into your mind.
I had one point, and then Bob Perry does.
And then we're actually going to have to quit because that the 1 o'clock was a little bit slow, I think, but we are about at time.
Well, it was shown in the political realm that when someone is presented with actual factual statement that contradicts a statement that someone is making, they tend to believe it even more strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that comes as a warning, not just to laugh at other people politically, but I have to be careful that I don't become stronger in a false idea when I hear the truth.
Yeah, at the end of many memorable relations, the people go back to their own place and they believe what they believed before even stronger. So, Bob, last word.
My quick comment was to sort of tie together what George said and what Gard said. George tried his experiment where, he puts his hand and it casts a shadow. Well, when light emanates, the light hasn't really emanated until truly emanated and done its work and resolved until it hits something, mm-hmm. and it's reflected back. And Gard's car mechanic's experience in his acts of speaking to his other patients, nothing's reflected back. So it's unsatisfying. It's as if the light never really emanated, mm-hmm. but Gard reflected it back, and so. That guy finally reached somebody, and that his light finally reflected back. And don't we all feel that in our conversations with people? How much more satisfying it is when someone mirrors back to us and makes it clear that we've been heard.
Thank you. That's all we have time for. But if you want more, we're going to have an adult discussion group in approximately now 8 minutes right here.